Accession number 14981, William Cornell, Reel 6.
Mr. W. Cornell, Reel 6. You said that you'd been issued with... What was KD? You said you'd been issued with KD before you left.
Oh, yes. Well, KD was khaki drill. Instead of the ordinary big, heavy, thick, it was khaki. It was a drill material, but it was very lightweight sort of material, khaki in colour.
What did they give you, exactly?
Oh, yes. In that respect, khaki drill was really... it's what we called a bush jacket. It was more or less like a jacket, but it had flaps on the pockets and things that, and it was lightweight. And don't then you had shorts to go with it to match them, of course. But they were all in this light khaki drill. Light khaki drill material, that's the word I'm trying to describe.
And the kind of hat you wore, what was that?
Yes, the hat then, at that stage, was called a bush hat. And it was like what you probably seen the Australians wear on the photographs, a big floppy brimmed hat, and it had a sort of cotton band round it, which is called the pogri.
Anything else did they issue with?
Not at that time, no, because you had your everything else with you. The other things you were going to get when you reached the battalion, you say. You only had your personal equipment, your mosquito net, things like that. You had that because you had to use that from day one in India, the mosquito net.
When you left England, did you get a medical with inoculations for the Far East?
Oh, yes, yes, and they were kept up right throughout the war. You had for tetanus and all the rest of them, typhoid, paratyphoid, ENB, and you had all of these inoculations from time to time.
Did they affect you immediately?
Some of them did and some of them didn't, actually. And some of them hurt and some of them didn't. That was just borne out by how many had used the same needle previously. The other needle got blunt, and if you were unfortunate, you would be at the tail end after the same needle. You'd really feel a prick.
When you got to Dullahy, you were just in effect in a holding situation.
That's right, that's true.
They didn't give you any jungle training, did they?
No. You had tough route marches, as I said before. You had route marches, and you had guard duties to do, and it was your turn and things like that. And but you had no jungle training as such.
Had they given you any talks about the Japanese at this stage?
Not at that stage, I can't remember a single one.
So in effect, you weren't particularly well prepared?
No, far from it. We were trained as soldiers, but we certainly weren't trained for fighting Japanese.
You said that you then moved to the battalion after some 2 weeks at Dullahy. Do you recall what date this would be?
No, I can't remember the date. I'm sorry about that. But all what happened was the group of men, there was approximately 40 in this small group, and we were the same group which had travelled right out from England, and we were going to the battalion as reinforcements. And I'll come to that as recording of the story later on. But we were sent as a group, we went trained, and sent with, I think it was a sergeant was put in charge of us to see that we got safely to where the battalion was stationed, which was Ahmednagar. Let's call it Ahmednagar.
Had the battalion been in action yet?
Yes. Now, when we got to the battalion, it was great. It was nice to be back into the battalion again. For all it was strange, but it was still that comfortable feeling at the back of your mind that you're back in your old regiment, and you as a group again, as a battalion. It was a nice feeling, and we're welcomed. There was no doubt about that. Welcomed with open arms. Everybody was sociable. We were told straight away. We were talked to by the officers, and what the battalion achieved up to then, which wasn't very much, but nevertheless, we were told all about it, and we settled in quite nicely.
Had they been in action in Burma at this stage?
Yes. Now, I don't know whether, I'm not quite sure again, whether it was the full battalion or just one or two companies of the battalion, but they'd been in service in the Arakan in Burma. Now, we heard some weird tales from these chaps, and they weren't very pleasant to listen to. But obviously, they'd been sent there, and they hadn't been trained for jungle warfare, and the same as all the troops at that time, they were completely routed by the Japanese.
What kind of stories were they telling you about the Japanese?
Oh, yes, well, it was the horror side of it, what they did if they caught it. They found instead of them, the British troops being caught and tied to a tree, and venous practice had been done on them, things like that. And about hiding up trees and shooting, you couldn't see them, but they could see you, and you were disadvantaged all the time.
And this is the kind of experiences they'd gone through in the Arakan.
That's true, that's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did they have any respect for the Jap?
I can't say there's much respect at all for them, no. Just these horror stories, which you could hardly call respect.
They received you, as you say, very well indeed. What was the camp like that you'd moved into?
Yes, the camp was good, actually. It was it wasn't really tented. It was what you call, you lived in bashes, which were sort of rough sort of built huts, and you lived in them. And of course, the battalion had made a marvellous place of it. Really, it had about everything, parade square and everything like that. And it was good. Everything was spotlessly clean, and you had accommodation. You could have baths. They weren't very elaborate, but however they were there, you could have a bath and things like that. You had a canteen, which was run in India. There was no such thing as the Nafi, but the canteens were run by the Indian contractors, actually. And you were for eggs, sandwiches and things like that when you were off duty, anything like that.
And was the food better than what you'd been getting?
I would say yes, it was better. It was very much the same, but it was better done, I would think, because, I mean, the cooks had more experience at this time and better facilities to cook with. And I would say the food was quite adequate. I never complained about it, because at that age you'd eat anything.
Was it the traditional English food, or were you getting Indian food?
As I said before, it happened all the way through India. It was mostly tinned food, but it was the way they prepared it in different ways, which probably made it a little bit more attractive to eat.
Which company did you move into?
I moved straight into A Company. That was number 3 platoon in A Company.
Who was your commanding officer?
The commanding officer of the battalion, or the company. The company
we
commander.
We start with the battalion.
Yes, he was Captain Kelly. He was a Scotchman.
Do you recall your platoon commander?
Yes. Platoon commander was called Lieutenant Connolly.
And your section commander, do you recall his name?
Yes, the section commander was a marvellous person. He was called Corporal Breeden, actually. Unfortunately, he was killed later on, but he was a gentleman in every respect and a good soldier.
What kind of activities did you go into while you were at this place?
Yes, well, there again, I never found out the real story of what the role was supposed to be for the second day alive. I would be very interested to try and find out. But we weren't trained for jungle, that is a fact. At that stage, we had no jungle training for all that had been part of the battalion being in Action Arakan. We had no training of jungle training. We had ordinary soldiers training, but we were trained for amphibious assault. And that is the part which I've never been able to understand, what our role was supposed to be when we were in India, because it didn't turn out that way, no doubt. But from Ahmednagar, we did have training. Actually, we went to Bombay to do it, and it was on board an assault landing craft called the Dunera, that's right. Dunera, and it was fitted out with landing craft on the davits instead of lifeboats, and at a place just outside off Bombay, we carried out this embarking and disembarking into the assault boats, which was very, very interesting. A little bit dangerous, trying to scramble up nets and whatnot, but nevertheless very interesting. I lapped it up. I enjoyed it.
And this was basically the training that they were giving you at that time.
That's right. Apart from the ordinary, which was standard training of use of weapons and all that sort of thing, which went right from day one in the army. That carried on day after day, month after month.
How large was your section? How many men was there in it?
I think it was 10 men in the section. Roughly 10, I think that's right, because there was, in the platoon itself, there'd be around about 30 men, and there was three sections in each platoon.
What was the weaponry of the platoon section?
The weapons actually were, as I said, they were rifle sections, so obviously you had your rifle. In each section had one Bren gun, and then each section had one 2-inch mortar. And that was your weaponry, apart from your corporal, the leader of the section, who had, which was quite recently arrived in India, the Sten gun, which was a dead loss if ever a gun was.
And why was it a dead loss?
Well, actually, it would go off when you didn't want it to go off, and it wouldn't go off when you did want it to go off. That was the top and bottom of it. We called it Woolworth's machine gun. Because it was very unsuitable for jungle warfare, because if you're walking through it, would rush against a branch as you went past the tree or a shrub or something, and off it would go. And then had a habit of, when you didn't really need it, that it wouldn't go off. So it was that type of weapon. They told us marvellous tales about how good it was, but as a soldier, I couldn't agree with them.
So that's the section, the platoon, obviously three sections, there's three Bren guns.
That's right, yes, that's right. Uh-huh. And then, but in addition to that now, we had, I can't say I ever saw it used, but in the platoon headquarters, on top of the three rifle platoons, you had the headquarters platoon. And in that, what first came out of India, must have been early after my arrival in Ahmednagar, they had the Piat, which was, they'd never seen a one, actually, the battalion. And whereas back in England, we had actually had training with the Piat. So whereas they were newfangled with the Piat, this group, what came across from me, we had no interest whatsoever, because we'd fired a lone thing and all sorts with it. And that was the Piat, which was supposed to stop tanks.
How many platoons in your company?
Three platoons in the company.
And then you'd have company headquarters.
You had company headquarters.
Were there any other sections
then
attached to headquarters?
Battalion headquarters and things like that, but that was all on top of the numbers, because I think the battalion strength overall was round about near enough 1,000 men.
Was there any addition to the weaponry at company level?
Yes, not at company level. You would have. Now I'm not sure whether it was company 11, but you had a carrier section, and you also had a medical section, a stretcher bearer. They were dual role during the war. They were, I mean, at this stage there's quite a lot of ceremony with the daylight, because they had a good band and they also had a good football team. But as regards weaponry, I don't think it did, was in the battalion. It came into various sections of the division or your brigade, rather than things like your guns and whatnot. But we had the artillery wasn't within the battalion itself and things like that. I think that's the question which you meant, was it? Mm.
Which brigade of the division were you in?
It was 6th Brigade.
Infantry
Brigade.
And the division?
It was the 2nd Division, the Crosskeys 2nd Division. And if I remember, it was 33 Corps, if I remember rightly, I might be wrong.
Was this a large camp which had other regiments in it?
It was a large camp, but the other regiments weren't immediately adjacent to it, maybe 2 or 3 miles further along. So it was spread over a considerable area, the whole brigade. But each battalion even, not just each battalion, obviously, tried to outdo the other regiments, who in our brigade were the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the Royal Berkshires. That was the other two battalions of the brigade, and so it was quite a bit of ceremony. inter-rival which went between them all. It was all in good fun.
You've mentioned the food. What was the water situation?
We had no problems whatsoever with water. You could have as much as you want. There was drinking water taps. You could drink your heart's content, so there was no problem with water whatsoever. But we were told, obviously, that we never had to drink untreated water. In other words, if we went into a village or anything, you couldn't drink, you weren't allowed to drink local water or anything like that.
Did they issue you with any tablets to put into water?
Oh yes, you had what you called water purifying tablets. And you always had those, of course, but whereas the intention was that you only used them in a dire emergency, was the whole idea behind those. They had horrible taste.
The protection against malaria, were you given anything for that?
Yes, well, you had a mosquito net. And at dusk, every day at dusk, you had to rub this vile-smelling cream all over the exposed parts of your body, your face and things like that. And then when you actually went into your bed, charpoy it was as called, with a bamboo frame, and you had to erect a mosquito net over it. And then on top of that, you had a daily intake of mepiquine tablets, which turned you completely yellow, and were supposed to get malaria away.
These would be an army issue, which you would have to take.
Oh yes, you're an alternative. Yeah, they were given to you by a non-commissioned officer, and they weren't just put in your hands so you could throw them away. You were made to swallow them in front of them, and that was daily routine.
How often a day did you get them?
One a day. Mm-hmm.
And that was the only effect they had, just the colouring? It didn't have any other effects upon you?
No. I can't say they did. No. Your urine was yellow, in fact, and things like that, but any effects, I wouldn't say any at all.
Sanitation, how did you get through that?
Yes, well, again, as I said, the battalion was very organised at this time, and the latrines were moved periodically. They were, you know, kept well away from where you slept and things like that and dined, but it was only composed of a long trench scooped out of the ground. And strung across the top of this trench was a rather thick, heavy log from end to end. And you sat just squatted over the top of that. And that was then. And what happened was the pioneer platoon had the unsavory job of filling that over once every day with a new layer of earth and so on. When it was quite near the top, they filled it in altogether and dug a new one and so on.
Did it smell a bit?
Oh, it certainly did. There's no doubt about that.
You didn't dawdle?
No doubt whatsoever. No, it was the only privacy you had, it had a canvas screen round the whole thing. But as regards inside, there was completely no privacy whatsoever. You all sat along this pole, and that was all there was to it.
It must have been an opportunity to catch up on gossip, camp gossip.
It was. That's where the room was started. That's quite true. All the rooms about where you were going and everything else, it all occurred in there. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you could get baths. What were the washing facilities like?
Well, at Abadaga, there was sort of primitive type of shower. It was tanks of water suspended above you, and you pulled a cord, and more or less a bucket of water came down on top of you.
Were you still paraded for showers? You had to go at a certain time.
You were actually. You had what was called the bath parade, and that was to make sure that you did get bathed. As simple as that.
Did you have any problems with creepy crawlies, lice, other insects?
No, I would never. At that stage, later on, perhaps yes, but at that stage, no. The things you did say, the natural things, were things like which you're warned about, your common sense told you to keep away from, but not that you had much choice really, but things like scorpions and ants. Now, ants could cause tremendous havoc. There was two kinds of ants basically out there, the white ones and the red ones. We used to put them together and make them fight each other. But the White Ants, the smaller of the lot, if you didn't move your kit bag periodically, you'd lift it up one day and find no bottom in it. You'd be all eaten completely away with these White Ants. Because you were punished, because that was an offence, because it had proved that you hadn't moved your kit bag there.
Did you have to check your bedding regularly for these creatures getting in?
We had, oh yes, I think that was, I'm not sure it was on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, but the only bedding you had all the time in the army, it wasn't like the RAF with white coloured shades and all the rest of it, the only bedding a soldier in the infantry had right from day one was a blanket. You had no shades, no pyjamas, no nothing like that. And what happened was, periodically, you were made to take your bedding out of your hut and put it outside, and the strong sunshine was supposed to kill anything what was on it.
Did men provide their own personal pyjamas, or did they just sleep?
No, I never once saw a soldier with a pair of pyjamas, only in hospital.
So basically, you slept either nude or with your underclothing.
That's right, with your short pants on, that's about all.
The effect of the climate, you'd been in India a number of weeks now, was that affecting you in any way?
Actually, it did. More or less stuck with me right throughout my time in India and Burma. And that was where I was troubled. Not that it really bothered me all that great extent, but I did start having quite a lot of headaches. And I remember going sick once over. Reported about these headaches, so I was getting a little bit worried. It was unpleasant trying to do it due to the violent headache. But the MO said not to worry, says you were issued with a headache with your kit when you came to India. So that was that.
The health of the unit, was it good by and large?
Oh yes, excellent. I mean, at that stage you were absolutely fighting fit. You were at the peak of your time in life, where all your training, your physical training and whatnot, and your conditions had made you very, very fit. There's no doubt about that. You could tackle a pack of anything.
Were they still insisting on a high standard of turnout and kit?
Yes, oh yes, very much so, very much so. That the only time that was ever laxed was in actual action, but once back out of action, you were straight back onto this pomp and ceremony, and everything had to be perfect again.
Did you get any opportunity for recreation at this stage before you went out into action?
We had games like, as I said, this rivalry between battalions in the brigade, games like football matches and things like that. And occasionally they played an Indian team. It was strange to see the Indian footballers come out onto the field with bare feet. But that's how it happened. But we had a good football team, and we also had a good band. The band used to give us a chance now and then to listen to some music and put a show on for us. And it was great stuff.
Had you been out long enough to form or hear of the opinions of the Indian soldier? Were they in high regard by the Indian soldiers?
Well, the 2nd Division, I think at that time, later on there was two, but at that stage there was only one completely white division in India, and that was the 2nd Div. We hadn't a very high regard for the Indian soldiers, I'm afraid, because the transport companies, not our own transport, they were driven by our own white soldiers, but maybe farther along the heavier stuff, and it was all entrusted to the Indian drivers in the trucks, and they were notorious for wrecking the trucks.
Mail, was that coming through quite often?
The mail, it was a very sore point actually, the mail. Early, it did improve later on, but in early days it was taking anything up to 3 months to receive a letter from home. And a lot can happen in 3 months, and sometimes if you had moved, well, it took even longer than 3 months to reach you. I don't think, there was odd things went astray, but basically, I would think 90% of mail what was sent off from England did arrive where it was supposed to.
Was it important to receive mail? How much was it looked upon?
It was a tremendous failing. You have now. I mean, when the mail arrived, it was handed down through the battalion, actually to your platoon. And then when the mail arrived, you all gathered in a group. And as the corporal went through the letters, he read the name, shouted the name, he went forward and picked up your mail. And after it was over, you'd see all of the platoon, all the members, scurry away into corners, or sitting down in corners, running out the road and reading the letters. Nice feeling.
It must have been hard on men who weren't getting mail.
That's true, that's very true, that's very true. And it was, actually, most of the troops were very sympathetic towards these people. There was quite a few, but they used to share whenever they got a parcel from them. They would automatically share it with these people who didn't receive it. And even if they hadn't a parcel, they would talk about things that were happening, but the information they'd received in the emails about England, because it was all sent it and all that, but nevertheless it was shared with them as best as it could be.
It must have affected their morale not to be getting mail or...
That's true.
Or having it, or it's stopping.
Yes, yes, you couldn't help feel sorry about it, because you could tell even... I mean, it all happened, let's face it. It wasn't always good news they received from home, but they did receive letters. It's quite common for one man to receive a letter saying his wife had gone away with somebody else and things like that. And it wasn't all good news, but...
What happened in that case if you had a colleague who received that kind of a letter?
Well, there was nothing could be done about it, really. The man was left... sorted out the best way he could himself, but there was no help from the army. I mean, what help could they give them? I mean, was many thousands of miles away.
Was the padre involved? Could he go to the padre?
He could go to the padre, that's true. And but what actually, I suppose the padre could write a letter back and things like that, but I had no personal knowledge of it myself, so I can't really talk about it.
So obviously you were writing home, as with the other people in the battalion. These letters would be censored, were they strictly?
Oh, yes, by all means, everything was censored. At first, it was letters, you said, I've got a little bit later on, might have been about that time when they got the sort of letter cards, which I think I showed you one before. No, they were just a little form. You couldn't put a lot on them, but with being light, very light, obviously a lot more of them could be transported back to England by aircraft rather than by sea. And then the times came down from 3 months for these little letter cards, they were called, to probably a fortnight or so they were in England, which was a great thing.
Your food was adequate, you say. You had plenty of water.
Mm-hmm.
What about drink, spirits, alcohol?
Yes, well, what happened was, I think once a month, you were allowed a ration of beer. It was, I think it was 2 bottles per man. A month, and it was always quite an occasion when the beer ration came, because you gathered round, as I say, in your own little groups and chatted and chunted and right until, you know, half through the night with your 2 bottles of beer.
So this would be looked upon with great enthusiasm.
Exactly.
And that helped morale.
That's quite true, it did though, yes. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Was it good beer?
At that time, the beer we were getting was an Indian beer, actually. Well, all you could say it was beer. Nothing like Newcastle Brown Ale.
Cigarettes, were they coming through?
Cigarettes, no problem whatsoever. In fact, right through my army service, there was only once when I was ever short of cigarettes. And they were very cheap again, but the English cigarettes... The only way you could probably get those at that time were in a parcel from home. I remember getting parcels with packets of Craven Ale, and but up then it was mostly, I would think, South African cigarettes, sea to seas and things like that. They were cigarettes, but they certainly weren't really good ones.
How important were they, though, to get a cigarette, to have them in plentiful supply?
Well, at that time you couldn't imagine life without them, as simple as that. Every opportunity you got, you were allowed to smoke. You were called a smoke break, and even on a route march, in every hour of march, and you had a 10-minute break, which was obviously the first thing out was the cigarettes.
It You've mentioned parcels, Mr. Cornell. What kinds of things were you getting in parcels?
Yes, what there was, you'd have razor blades to shave with, British stuff. You would have cigarettes, and sometimes even a piece of cake, or things like that, which you went wrapped up and thrown away at the corner of the parcel. But it was little luxuries, actually. Not there was much luxury in England them days, but they were luxuries as far as we were concerned.
Were you getting parcels from your home?
Yes, I got them at regular intervals throughout the war. And as I say, most of them arrived. Occasionally they didn't, but most of the time they did.
Were any of the voluntary people sending special things for you?
I never received anything from anybody apart from my mother.